And guest to us, our friend from Casper, Wyoming, Reed Rosenthal, with us this morning, talking a little bit about, it's a time we brought back the character traits of the Old West. First of all, Happy New Year. We haven't spoken since then.
Happy New Year, Rod. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you very much. Should we bring back the character traits of the Old West? I guess first what we have to figure out is, what were those traits?
Well, you know, the traits, very briefly, I think is... it's a return to the values of the Old West. You know, there's five traits that I can identify which you can apply to business, you can apply to government, and we can apply to our individual lives. Number one, you know, say what you mean and mean what you say.
Mm.
Let's stop this politically correct nonsense, doublespeak, and what I call right-hand glitter distraction and left-hand reality. And if you want a hand, look at the end of your arm. Stop looking for entitlement. Stop looking to the government to be your end-all, be-all. And let's go back to typical American self-reliance, which is what built this country to begin with. Number three, neighbor to neighbor. I mean, invest in your community. Stop looking to Washington. Look local. There's lots of power between you and your neighbors in your community. If you happen to be in a bigger city, you know, your neighborhood, and in a smaller town, of course, that's a compact political and social unit that people need to tap into and use. And number four, be secure in your convictions. Be proud of your beliefs and stand up. I mean, people need to say what they think. They need to do the research, to be educated about not only the history of this country and the Constitution, but the impacts of current events on both of those two touchstones of the American spirit and the American way. And last but not least, you know, let's get back to basics. Let's get back to the vision of the founders. Let's get back to the Constitution. Let's get back to that concept which I think Thoreau very eloquently stated, that government that governs least governs best.
I would say that that is a very valid point. Can this work in? We know that it can work in a small community. I think we see it every day in the cow counties of rural Nevada, and I think you see it in your area. I think you see it in many places in what would be considered the Old West. But can it come to fruition in a big city?
Well, you know, I think it can, because big cities are really broken down into neighborhood blocks.
Yeah.
Which gives you your quote-unquote local community. And those neighborhood blocks can be geographic. You know, sometimes they're racial, sometimes they're religious, sometimes they're based on immigration. You know, certain Italians are in one neighborhood and Irish are in another. I mean, whatever it happens to be, there are components to build on even in teeming urban areas. And once again, I think that these concepts, these five really basic concepts, I mean, they are who we are as a people. We can apply those concepts to virtually any problem we're facing today, including the problem of federal largesse,
mm-hmm.
and federal bankruptcy. I mean, let's face it, everybody talks about the $15 trillion or soon to be $15 trillion primary national debt. Nobody talks about the other $122 trillion in unfunded entitlements. You know, Social Security, Medicare and Medicaid, and, of course, what the unions have been able to ram through while everybody's been asleep at the switch, the $56 billion, or maybe it's $66 billion, in government pensions and other entitlements after government employees are no longer providing services to the general public.
Well, we were able to see government at work in smaller towns here in our neighborhood over the course of the last couple of years. We had a landfill company that thought it was going to be all right to open a dumping grounds here, and when the people found out about it, they didn't really like it, and they didn't like it in mass, and we ended up passing a county question to prohibit that type of business here. We also spent many days at the courthouse, at the county commission meetings, having 150, 200 people coming and making their case against this, and it was voted down. Now, that was a perfect case of small government doing things because of public involvement. The things that you mentioned, though, for instance, knowing your neighborhood and neighbors and things like that, I think that does happen here in our neighborhoods. But I know living in Las Vegas that I went 10 years in the same house, and I think I did know the neighbors on both sides, but that was about it.
Well, sure, but I mean, whose choice was that?
Oh, I don't know if it was anybody's choice. I don't know if it was an overt or a covert mission. I don't know.
Well, you know, it was probably a little bit of both, and that's really my point. I mean, I think we need to start reaching out. It's much easier, of course, to stay in your cocoon.
Yeah.
But I think it's much more dangerous individually for your children and for your children's children and certainly for the country right now to do so. You know, not everybody is gregarious. Not everybody is going to, you know, run around and pump the hands of every neighbor. But there's little things you can do. I mean, a wave, a nod, a smile, you know, a Happy New Year. That all gets the ball rolling in terms of beginning the very foundations of neighborhood cohesiveness. And, you know, many, many, many neighborhoods put together, many, many small towns put together, have a huge voice at the state level. And of course, that's the level from which we ought to start transforming the federal government.
You know, it's funny you say that because growing up on the East Coast, we acknowledged everybody. Now, we were pretty behind the times, obviously, because at one time everybody there wore hats, and they would tip their hats at people. Nobody wears a hat anymore, but you would shake people's hands and you would acknowledge their existence. When I came from New Jersey to Los Angeles, I didn't see that. They didn't even want to acknowledge that. Now, the reason why I bring back that small difference is that now I see people with Walkmen, with iPhones, with, listen to me, Walkmen, MP3s, you know, iPads, iPhones. I adore, you know, not talking to people. And you see groups of people, and this is one of my favorites. You see a group of four women walking down the street, and it looks like the opening to Sex and the City, except they're all on the phone talking to other people, and they're having no interaction at all with the people they're standing next to.
You know, it's a very valid point. I mean, listen, this is a conscious choice that people have to make. That's really what I'm trying to say. You know, America's having some tough times right now. My personal opinion is that they're going to get tougher before they get better.
Really?
Well, you know, the machinery that's been set in motion, well, literally for the last 80 years, but certainly in the last 10 to 15 years, and exponentially in the last 2 to 4, that's taken a long time to have these material adverse effects. And setting the machinery in motion to counterbalance that, to dismantle it, and to do this right, to go back to the basics, that's going to take some time to have an effect too. But, you know, the sooner we get started, the sooner we're going to see the light at the end of the tunnel. I mean, it's just that simple. It takes a long time for policies, decisions, and changes to wind its way through, you know, what has become a country of 320 million very diverse folks. But going back to individualism, going back to self-reliance, going back to neighborhood and small community values, and bringing those from the bottom up to force change at the highest levels and dismantle this monster that's become this federal government, you know, will have long-term, hugely beneficial effects. And, you know, listen, it might not be towards the end of our lifetimes, although I think we'll see results in 5 to 10 years, but it's certainly the right thing to do for our kids and our children's children.
Unfortunately, here in our county of Humboldt, in the last week, we've had 2 attempted suicides of teenagers, school kids, one of them successful. I have never seen such a rash of suicide attempts by youths as we've had in this country the last 5 years. Where do you think it starts?
You know, I think it starts because, and I don't know the situations, I'm not in your local news area.
Right.
But, you know, I think that there is a there's a general uneasiness across the country right now. I have no idea of the specific instances. You're always going to have the person, you know, the individual who's unstable.
Right.
A la
right.
that mess that's, in Tucson.
Of course.
And but, you know, I also think that kids are impressionable. And if things have been happening, you know, in their within their personal life, whether it's with other kids or at home, there's stresses and pressures which, once again, the things we've been talking about have created within a home environment through nobody's fault, you know, that can all manifest itself into kind of deep despair. One of the things I think schools can do to get kids more interested in life, more interested in hope, more interested in the future, more interested in America, and more vested in themselves is kind of return to, I've always thought a story teaches better than a textbook. I'm really convinced of that. I mean, I'm looking back at my own educational background.
Sure.
And you know, one of the ways to get people interested, reinterested in America, what she is, how she got there, and its history, so that we can go back and use that as a touchstone, is historical fiction. I mean, it's one of the reasons I'm writing this series of novels.
It's and tell us a little bit about the novels and who should read them.
Well, the first book is Threads West. It's the namesake of the six book series. It begins in 1855, and it's about the uncommon threads of lives from all around the world. You know, it's really kind of a book on immigration, if you will, the first book, that weave together into the tapestry of an emerging nation. It's a very interesting point in American history. It's kind of that point where it's the change of reels. You know, reel one, the East, reel two, the West,
mm-hmm.
in terms of American history. And it's that point in time that America and Europe and the rest of the world kind of drew in their collective breath and got ready to exhale it with a rush toward the West and the Rockies. And it's fascinating because it's America on the cusp of greatness. And I wrote it because it's a story I want to tell and because I'm fascinated with American history. But one of my missions is to get this into schools. And I've been pretty successful in doing that. I'm speaking to a number of middle and high schools and colleges around the West, and you know the book has become part of their curriculum. And my point is that through the book, they have an enjoyable, I hope, enjoyable story that catches their interest, weaved and woven with historical fact and fiction. You know, from abolition to broken Indian treaties to westward migration to establishment of ranch, cattle, and other commercial operations in the West. And the last book, the sixth book, will be set in the modern contemporary West, real time, with the West's political troubles. And, you know, the book has kind of an additional character to the 38 characters over the four generations and 170 years that the series will cover, and that's the land. The land is a palpable character in this book because I think that the land kind of shapes our personalities. It's a source of sustenance. It's certainly the source and root of food, water, air, I mean, you name it, energy, what we put in our cars. The land, under all lies the land, and the changes in the land, along with the changes in people's personalities and America's personality, is what this historical romance series, I might add, tracks. So that is kind of my mission, and I'm delighted to see students engrossed in the story, you know, and understanding the historical facts that underlie the fictional tale.
Now, absolutely. Now, first of all, how can people get the books? I guess I better ask that right now because I'll forget.
Oh, no problem. Well, they can check with their local bookstore. It's just starting to get in there. We're on our fourth printing, which is pretty amazing.
Wow.
In 90 days. And thank you, readers. And if your local bookstore does not have it, then BarnesandNoble.com has the book and Nook, Kindle over on Amazon. And you can also go to our website, www.threadswestamericansaga.com.
threadswestamericansaga.com. Now, I we've talked about this before. I hated history. I just didn't like it. I thought it was a bunch of numbers and the dates, and if I was going to do that, I might as well do math, and I'd rather do math. And I had a great history teacher. His name was Dr. Elon Smith, and I was in seventh or eighth grade. And he gave me a hunger for history. Without him, I don't know if I ever would have liked history. And you mentioned it's the stories, it's the personalities, because there's this interesting side to everybody who's ever walked the face of this earth.
Absolutely.
I mean, and it is as simple as that. There truly is. And that's an amazing concept. I mean, now, the books span 170 years. You live in this year. Do you see similarities and do you see cycles as this country that has progressed are similar to the one that we're in now?
You know, I'm working on the second book, and ironically, the fourth book is just about done. I kind of got out of sequence, but I was really interested in that.
Math wasn't your strong suit.
But, you know, that's a great question because, yes, I do. I mean, these things have moved cyclically. In fact, the antebellum period, which the first book is set just before, and the second book, Maps of Fate, which is coming out March, April, is set in, is probably that the first or the second time in American history that the federal government began a pretty dramatic expansion. It was prompted by the Civil War, it was prompted by Reconstruction, it was prompted by what became a tidal wave of westward migration after 1855. Mm-hmm. And yes, absolutely. And then, you know, that federal largesse was kind of beat back in the later 1800s, and then it began to grow again with Woodrow Wilson, probably the first progressive, you know, we've had as a president. And then it was beat back again after FDR in World War II. And you can also see the same economic trends, which are really interesting. You know, you look at Wilson and FDR, and they were pretty much big government, big tax, big spending, government can solve your problems type mentalities. The results after each of their terms was either a depression, in the case of Wilson and his successor, or in the case of FDR was, if people think back, in 1945 we had very high inflation, very high interest rates, very high unemployment. There were other factors, veterans returning from World War II, etc. And it wasn't until Eisenhower kind of took the reins, scaled back government, lowered taxes, that we began to really take off as an economy. You can see the same thing with Jimmy Carter, right? Big government,
true.
Big tax,
inflation,
you know, big spending,
going rampant.
Government will solve all your problems. What was the result of Jimmy Carter? It was the second worst recession after this one in 80, 81, and 82. We had, 15% inflation, 18% mortgage rates, 11% unemployment. I mean, people don't remember this.
Yeah.
Reagan came in, scaled back government, scaled down taxes, you know, started to hand things back to states and back to individuals, and we had a huge boom. I think it was 22 million jobs in 8 years. And then you can see the same trends happening right now. So, you know, we need to, this is one of the reasons we need to go back to history. We need to understand it. We need to stay away from those things which history has taught us do not work, and which are antithesis to the American spirit and the American principle. And we need to put more energy into and more time into those things that have proven over time do work.
It does seem, though, that when the time comes that we have to remember those things the most is the time that we happen to get a little scattlebrained and forget them.
You know, there's two things that I think happen. And I see this actually in the writing of the novels, you know, in the historical. There's a lot of historical texture in these books on purpose. When people get complacent, when things are going really, really well, they tend to get involved in their personal lives and their personal ambitions, all of which is great. But what's not great is they lose sight of the bigger picture. And people forget that the macro, that is the United States government, and or the planet, affects them in their everyday life. You know, I'll give you one example. When there's regulations put in on ranching, farming, or energy production, these are all things that come from the land. So these are land-related regulations.
Mm-hmm.
What is the result to somebody who lives in a big city? I mean, their first thought is, oh, well, I feel sorry for that poor guy out there in Colorado or Nevada or whatever. Gee, that's too bad. Guess what? That afternoon, they're going to fill up their car. They're going to go down to the grocery store. They're going to heat their house, and they're going to pay more for it. Everything is interconnected, and people
sure.
need to really stay in touch much more than they have in the past with the macro, not just the micro of their own lives, because it's all interrelated now, particularly with communication and your example, the four ladies using their iPhones.
Go ahead. Read? Yeah,
so,
yeah. Go ahead.
Yes. So anyway, my point is that people need to kind of take off the blinders. They need to be much more aware, not only of their local neighborhood, community, and small town, but they really need to be watching what's happening in Washington. And I will caution that one of the things they need to be watching is the difference between what people say and what they do. You know, as we say out west, you walk the walk.
And you also got to keep your eye on the ball.
You got to keep your eye on the ball. And, you know, some of the folks we have in Washington right now, particularly in the administration, they're really good at kind of holding out that right hand with a glittering coin and saying, look at all this good stuff. Meanwhile, the left hand is doing something which is highly detrimental to the economy, to our rights, to the Constitution, because that's their ideology.
We understand.
I'll give you a perfect example.
Unfortunately, I'm out of time, Reed,
okay.
But I'll tell you one thing. We understand Siegfried and Roy and sleight of hand here in Nevada, that's for sure. Be well, my friend. We'll talk to you soon. That's Reed Rosenthal with us this morning. Good stuff. I'm Rod William Stoll. Bottom of the hour news next.
From the Nevada Talk Radio Network newsroom, sitting in for Rachel Marie, I'm Rod William Stoll. It was up to the commissioners of Washoe County to pick the replacement for longtime state senator Bill Raggio, and the first one in got the job. 12 other applicants followed former state assemblyman Greg Brower and answered the same questions he did, but Brower wins the seat in District 3. Why was Brower first to interview? Because the applicants were taken in alphabetical order. Brower might not want to give up his current job, as District 3 might be a thing of the past after this session of the state houses, as it is time to redistrict during the session. Greg Brower has been practicing law in the private sector after leaving the U.S. Attorney's Office in mid-2009. He lost his seat in the state assembly to Sharon Angle. One of the first bills that the new legislature will look at is a bill sponsored by Assemblyman Paul Aisley. The Compassion Access in Nevada Act provides the legalization of medical marijuana. The bill was penned by Rhonda Shade. Shade had been busted by police last year at her medical marijuana dispensary. In Nevada, you can register and grow up to 7 pot plants a year for personal consumption, but you have to register and have an ID card. The bill would eliminate the necessity of the card, and it would also give caretakers the right to grow marijuana for their patients. We'll have more NTRN News after this. One of the most photogenic Americans is also a guy that a lot of Americans just love to see, Benjamin Franklin. And now, once again, it's time for All About the Benjamins, Monday through Thursday night at the Model T Hotel, Casino, and RV Park. It's all about the Benjamins, adding $100 to the grand prize every day. It's all about the Benjamins. Come on and see what it's all about. And for the football playoffs on the weekend, you can win yourself a football cooler. It's huge, it's spectacular, and it's only at the Model T. And by the way, 2-for-1 specials are still one of the greatest deals in town every Monday and Friday at the T. 2-for-1 prime rib on Monday nights, and Fridays, it's 2-for-1 steak and shrimp. The Model T Hotel, Casino, and RV Park. Pete Goicoechea made his appearance at the Humboldt County Board of Commissioners meeting yesterday, and the senator from Eureka painted a rather bleak picture for the fiscal shape of the state of Nevada, but was quick to say that the cow counties were doing much better than the major cities. In the afternoon portion of the regularly scheduled meeting, there was a discussion focusing on obtaining a qualified consultant to help the commissioners respond to the jungle application to NDEP. The commissioners agreed that it was imperative not to get caught unprepared for whatever situation comes up in the future. Parts of the discussion centered around the fact that there had been a stay put on the case, which was thought to mean that pursuing the issue further before it was lifted was not allowed. Yet Jungo continued with permitting and licensing processes. The 5-0 vote on the motion will have the county looking for representation. KWNA weather, 43 degrees for the high today, while partly cloudy skies abound throughout the night with an overnight low of 24. Thursday's high, 43 degrees. And that's KWNA News.
My Desert RV, 5575 East Winnemucca Boulevard, now has even more to offer. With their new store expansion, with brand new line of RV supplies, featuring their new sandwich pack, where you can put on all of your own fixings, homemade stew and choice of chips and a soda for only $7. Coupled with their already beautiful recreation hall, there's now brand new shuffleboard courts. Yep, it's simply the best oasis in the West. All at affordable daily